The very first broadcast occurred Saturday evening, April the 26th, 1952, 24 years ago tomorrow. The script revolved around a 12-year-old boy who was to become a legend in the West.
Can you direct me to the marshal's office?
Yes, ma'am, right here. I'm Marshal Dillon.
Well, I left Cottonwood as soon as I got your telegram. I'm Miss Bonnie. Where's my boy?
Oh, we have him, ma'am, safe and sound. Here, let me help you down. Hitch that horse, Chester. Right this way, ma'am.
Oh, I'm so sorry he put you in all that trouble, Marshal. The truth of the matter is he's a wild one and no mistake. Takes after his father, one scrape after another.
He was no trouble at all. I enjoy children. I like to have him around. Bub, your ma's here. Son? Chester, where's the boy? Did you let him slip past you?
No, sir, Mr. Dillon. He never got past me. Look, the back door's open.
He seen me and he hightailed it, the devil.
We'll round him up for you, ma'am. Don't worry.
Oh, I don't know why I bother hauling him back. If he's run away once, he's run away a thousand times. This time he ran because I wouldn't buy him a gun. He wanted a real one. That boy's just gun crazy, I swear. I got him a nice Barlow knife instead.
Barlow knife?
I reckon it didn't signify, and off he runs.
Barlow knife? A kid. Chester finds a kid.
Marshal, has he done something bad with it? I told him to use it careful. He promised he'd use it careful.
Never mind, Chester. He's got Clay's strawberry roan. We'd never catch up to him.
Oh, I try to bring him up right. I tell him to be good, but he don't listen. He just don't listen.
Now, calm yourself, ma'am. Just calm yourself.
Here's his little bundle, Mr. Dillon.
What? Here, give it to me. It's pretty heavy. Here, you're better at knots than I am. Open it, will you?
The moment he was born, he's been nothing but tribulation to me.
Now, please, ma'am. What's he got in it, Chester?
Shirt, stockings, piece of sausage, and this.
44 double action.
Yes, sir, Mr. Dillon. That's Clay's gun. Sonny didn't manage to keep it long, did he?
Well, if he wants a gun that bad, he's bound to get hold of another one somewhere, somehow. Chester, call Mr. Hightower over.
Hey! Hey, Mr. Hightower!
Oh!
Come on over. Mr. Dillon wants you.
Marshal, could I have please a drink of water?
What? Oh, Ziegler, I forgot all about you. Chester, where are the keys?
Yeah, right there on the desk.
There we are. It'll be safe for you to go home now.
I can go back by the farm.
Yeah, that's right. I'll send for you for the trial.
Oh, danke schön. Danke schön.
Watch where you're going, you dumb...
Excuse me, Peter.
Yes, Marshal.
Mr. Hightower, it appears that we can do business after all. Get some paper and a pencil. I want some notices printed.
Fire away.
Wanted for murder.
Wanted for murder.
What's the boy's name?
Barney. William Barney.
William Barney.
William Barney.
Age 12. Height about 5 feet. Hair light. Eyes blue. I don't suppose he's known by any other name.
No. Everybody just called him Billy. Or the kid.
Also known as Billy. The kid.
Return to the biography of Gunsmoke in just one moment. And now back to Gunsmoke.
Billy the Kid was the first show by Walter Brown Newman. Received good reports, but nobody was quite sure upstairs whether we had a hit or a miss because our leading man didn't sound like a leading man. Bill Conrad was not playing Matt as a warm, understanding, paternal figure whatsoever.
During the first few months, other writers were called in to mold the characters.
Les Crutchfield was a writer who was to become one of the solid contributors to Gunsmoke, writing possibly 70 or 80 scripts. Les wrote a writer named Herb Purdom, Joe Murcott, Lou Houston, Tony Ellis, a cross-section of the better writers in town. But each week it meant that Meston had to do a little editing and a little fixing and a little adjusting on the script. And after about a year, John said that he didn't quite know why he was working this hard and not having the fun of writing them himself. So he left CBS, left an extraordinarily good job with a great deal of promise, as a matter of fact, on what was really a gamble, because who knew how long Gunsmoke would go. So for the next 3 or 4 years, until the television series started, John wrote basically every Gunsmoke, writing anywhere between 40 and 52 scripts a year. So he was a busy man.
Colorado-born John Meston had his own views about the West and how the Gunsmoke characters should be developed and portrayed.
Well, I don't like phony stuff, and I knew something about the West, sure. The way people are, the way they talk, the way they behave. And I never liked heroes much. So we kind of reversed everything. And we did away, I tried to do away, we did with narration a lot, which was sort of an innovation, I think, at the time. You know, we tried to make him just an honest character, not a crook like Wyatt Earp and people like that who are just bums. Try to make him an honest guy, and a guy with a sense of tragedy. A guy who didn't particularly enjoy the job, did it. But then it took quite a while because, you know, Walter put Chester in. We had worked on him a great deal for a long time. And Kitty and Doc had to develop, and Matt had to develop, and we did this over a long period of time. No, we worked very closely. I didn't go around, hang around TV much, but in the radio I was there all the time. Well, I'm always hired. The very best actors, no question of that. You know, they couldn't read a line. They'd let me know with great pleasure, and they're generally right. I don't know how to write dialogue so it could be read and short. I always wrote short. I never wrote speeches like that, or I never, you know, unless it's absolutely necessary, occasionally for an effect. But the characters were developed very slowly. We'd go on after the shows, Conrad and Norm and I, and whoever else was around, Parley, whoever was interested, sit around and discuss the show. And we were all interested in discuss character and this and that. Why they should do this or that, or how they should behave. It was kind of a joint effort.
Meston once expressed his views in detail. Here's Gunsmoke announcer George Walsh reading a classic Meston letter addressed to the editor of the New York Tribune.
It isn't often that a writer, or any man, is given an opportunity to destroy a figure he's always hated, a character that all his life has cluttered his landscape like a slum. And to be able to do so, and get paid for it to boot, is to be doubly blessed. My hated figure is the Western hero who rides along thumping his guitar, nasally singing a synthetic ballad, and looking for all the world like a fugitive from a cheap circus. I spit in his milk, and he'll have to go elsewhere to find somebody to pour the lead for his golden bullets. Now, the best way to destroy something bad is to ride it down with something better. And I've got a guy I think outclasses any of these phony big hats. His name's Matt Dillon. And his hair is probably red if he's got any left. He'd be handsomer than he is if he had better manners. But life and his enemies have left him looking a little beat up. And I suppose, having seen his mother back about 1840, struggling to take a bath in a wooden washtub without fully undressing, left his soul a little warped. Anyway, there'd have to be something wrong with him, or he wouldn't have hired on as a United States Marshal in the heyday of Dodge City, Kansas. Dodge at that time was the wildest town in America, and it was populated by men just as warped and more so than Matt Dillon. Consider this. The West, just after the Civil War, was in a sense a kind of arena for frustrated gladiators. Homicidal psychopaths gathered along the frontier and had themselves a real circus, with little or nothing to stop them from happily mowing one another down. And that more men didn't die in this senseless slaughter may be laid to their comparatively primitive weapons, and certainly not to any civilized tendencies on their part. It ended finally. The murderers killed one another off and gradually disappeared from this section of the American scene. But the end was partly hastened by a few strangers who happened to get their satisfaction killing on the side of the law. Sheriffs, marshals, and the like. I'm sure a few of these men had a hazy sense of what the coming of law and order meant, but for the most part, they looked on their role in the play of progress simply as a job. And they went ahead and did their job, often in the face of unbelievable odds, and then picked up their paychecks and went their way. Heroes? To us, now they were heroes, but to their contemporaries, the biggest hero was he who, by whatever means, murdered the greatest number of his fellow men. The rules were childishly simple. If the other man went for his gun before you did, you were free to kill him with immunity. And anyway, if there weren't too many unfriendly witnesses about, you could always claim he did, and probably get by with it just as easily. Matt Dillon, because of obvious reasons, he's a cut above the usual lawmen I've described. But he's not, I trust, so far above the real thing as to be pure fiction. And the hardest thing for me, the writer, is to keep him on paper from goofing off into the never-never land of pure heroism. And the hardest thing for Norman MacDonald, the producer-director, and Bill Conrad, the star, is to translate the script's attempt at authenticity into the living character of Matt Dillon. But we try, then try, and keep trying. Our attempt to create as realistic and entertaining a program as possible is not, of course, the only one of its kind. But we did precede, and were on the air, trying before the release of such pictures as High Noon and Shane. And we're still on the air, and we're still trying.
Certainly, one of the reasons for Gunsmoke's hold upon its audience was Meston's style of writing.
To try and analyze John Meston's contribution to the writing style of Gunsmoke would be difficult, because John's writing is not flashy, it's not filled with purple prose, it's not... If anything, it's understated and simple. John and I always felt that good Western writing didn't necessarily mean double negatives and so on, that it really required research and understanding of the cowboy, and John was an avid researcher. Also, of course, his boyhood in Pueblo, Colorado helped color his scripts, but John used a great deal of the language that came from the cowboys that he had known and the friends he had known in Colorado. For instance, there was one phrase that John always loved particularly. A cowboy was talking about his mare to another cowboy who asked if the mare was a fast runner. And the first cowboy looked for a moment and then said, yes, she's swift. She could run a hole in the wind. She set her mind to it. Well, this was the kind of phrase that John loved, because it was the man of the earth and the country using the things that he knew and using the things that he saw around him for descriptions, which gave the dialogue or the speech patterns a richness and a fullness. Was a strange combining of words and a strange combining of emotions that gave John's dialogue, as written in the Gunsmoke scripts, a special meaning that was hard for anyone else to duplicate. Meston always had a feeling about names, too. He felt that a name was a whole indication of the character that was to come. A friend of Matt's who arrives in town, if I remember correctly, was a ex-lawman or a lawman, and a friend of Matt's. Meston called him Nick Search, which is a marvelous way of painting the man's whole background just with a couple of words, or other names like Toke Morlin, or a funny little fellow who was running a town and was a crook, but a kind of a pathetic little crook. His name was Joe Fye. There was a doctor who came into town and got in trouble because he, well, because of the laudanum that he was putting in his medicinal bottles. His name was Professor Lute Bone, which is a marvelous name for a doctor. Or the buffalo hunter called Gatliff. John never gave Gatliff any name because he felt that Gatliff was enough. But he did mention that he was a man with speckled eyes, which is a beautiful way of describing a man. There was a family who lived out on the prairie who lived in a sod hut, a sad excuse for a home, and they were called the Beatles. As a matter of fact, John called the script Smoking Out the Beatles. When it was done on television, it was changed to Smoking Out the Nolans, for some reason that nobody yet has been able to figure out.
John Meston was a thorough technician and a writer of great integrity and accuracy.
This is Parley Bear, the talented and versatile actor who portrayed Chester Proudfoot.
And I think that since that era was probably the most colorful in Western history, that he strove to create and paint the most accurate image of the times that he could. And I think he succeeded. Now, so far as we know, you know what a genius John had for picking out names that described the character. Matt Dillon was so faithfully written and so impeccably reproduced by Royce the way Bill did it, that at one time we had a letter from the then Secretary or President of the Chamber of Commerce in Dodge City wanting to know, since they had already determined that Matt Dillon had lived in Dodge City, did we have accurate knowledge as to when he lived in Dodge City? Now, unless it was just a matter of coincidence and conjecture that there had at one time, according to the archives and the historical pages of Dodge City's history book, that there had been a Matt Dillon there, but so far as we knew, and so far as John Meston knew, Matt Dillon was completely a brainchild, as well as the name. And it was very flattering for Dodge City Chamber of Commerce to assume that we would know when he had lived there, when, so far as we knew, he never had. People came west for a variety of reasons, and chiefest among them, it seemed like, was a tragedy that had occurred either back east or in Europe. Or people came west, it's true, to forget or to hide something that some malfeasance of their own in the more civilized sections of the country. And I think the West, as it was developed, indeed our whole country, was developed as a result of disappointment elsewhere, and his pen had the ability to pick that up. There's a kind of trite expression, I don't even know who originated it. The whole world belongs to the actor for his use only, not to keep. He must give it back. And when you analyze that, it's kind of true. I know that I've seen lots of people, but I think, my, he would be fun to play. And then you're not above plagiarizing a little bit of that man's character, a little bit of his life, a little bit of his way of speech, a little bit of his background. And John did that. Chester and Matt were talking, and Matt asked Chester why he got up so early, and he said, well, I can't sleep. He said, it's a trait I have. As soon as the sun up, my feet start to sweat, and then I get uncomfortable, get up. Well, John knew a person who said that. Some old codger he had met said that he got up because there was something about the sun coming up caused his feet to sweat, and he became uncomfortable in bed, so he got up. Well, That was a good line for Chester to have. Humanisms. John did those things. Chester acquired this dog that he loved dearly, and the dog liked everybody but Chester, and after he had bitten him soundly, Chester's only comment was, "He'll come around." John Meston wrote realism. You could see the mud. You could see the slough that they were in. You could see the filth. But it was done because it was adroitly painted in.
Have you found him, Mr. Dillon?
Yeah.
I thought I'd better come along. You see...
Toby's dead, is that it?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, Gatliff's down there in the middle of the hollow. But we can't get anywhere near him as long as he's got that Sharp's rifle. He's killed a small herd of buffalo in there, and now he's lying out in the center of them.
Well, that's the darndest thing I ever heard of, Mr. Dillon. He must have gone crazy, just like Toby said.
Yeah.
What's he shooting at now? Mr. Dillon, the way he's spacing them shots...
Yeah, that's the signal for help, Chester. Come on.
Hey, maybe this is a trap.
Be ready to take cover behind one of these animals. It might be.
Sounds like he's been hurt.
Yeah. Keep your head up.
There he is. Behind that big bull.
Yeah, I see him.
Well, Mr. Dillon, he's all...
There have been horses in here. Indians.
My goodness.
Come on. His last effort, Chester. He's dead now.
Mr. Dillon, that's awful.
Yeah. Come on, let's get out of here. I don't know how the Indians caught Gatliff. He'd gone a little mad, and maybe that made it easy for him. But they finally got themselves a buffalo hunter. And into their unbelievably savage torture of him had gone all the hatred and desperation of a race being slowly starved and driven from their homeland. And then they'd put him there surrounded by his own bloody slaughter. And they'd gone off with a gesture of contempt, leaving his rifle and his ammunition by his side. And having seen what they did to him, I'll never know how he managed to fire even one of those shots. For all of his evil, Gatliff had died harder than any man I'd ever seen. Chester and I rode back to Dodge. And it was never mentioned between us again.
John is a most unique talent, a lovely man who is a great bleeder. He bleeds for everybody, and perhaps that is the key to the success of that show, is that it is so filled with the repulsion of man's inhumanity to man, seasoned and highlighted by red streaks of magnificent violence, and yet the final total compassion with whatever the problem was. You add all of those up, and they spell mother under any conditions.
The people were human beings.
Georgia Ellis, who portrayed saloon madam Kitty Russell.
Kitty was human, and some of them had very homely touches in them, like perhaps a dress fitting or a Howard fussing about how to kill a pain in the tooth, which might even have consumed a minute or 2 minutes. It was not continuous action or bloodletting or mystery or anything. You had a sense of continuity. You could almost taste the dust in the streets, perhaps. The beer wasn't very cold, but at least it was beer. And the cowboys were not clean. And the horses were sweaty. And not everybody was pretty and beautiful and wore white hats.
Supporting player, John Daner.
Each show had to do, yes, with Matt Dillon, but Matt Dillon in relation to some one individual, some one family that comes to town or that lives in town that has a problem. Which means that you didn't have so much plot as you had character, interesting people to listen to, you see. And this is what happened with the television Gunsmoke 2. It was a novelty. We were all so used to Hyo Silver's Away that this was a total departure into the area of serious examination of people and their problems. And then when you get that kind of writing and that kind of concept, it's a glorious thing for actors, because this is the very thing that an actor wants, to play a person, a human being.
Running through many of John's scripts is a thread of the dignity of man, and yet at the same time, so frequently, man's inhumanity to man, or the inescapability of life and problems in the Western frontier. One of the things that John did in his scripts was to paint the difficult position of a woman. Nowadays, we're inclined to say, well, if life's that difficult, why didn't they go somewhere else? And as John had his characters explain, where was there to go? They had no money. The household probably consisted of one mule, and you can't ride too far on one mule and no money. And if the woman did get into town, what was she going to do? She couldn't suddenly find work in a boutique. She either was a dance hall girl or something less. So the frontier life was a hard and unforgiving sort of life, as John pictured it, and I think quite accurately. One script that perhaps illustrates what I'm saying was a script called The Cabin. I remember parenthetically that John wrote this to go on the air after a particularly soft Christmas show, and he said, we can't have people think we're going to do soft shows, so he wrote The Cabin. Simply, the story was Matt finding himself almost isolated in a blizzard, approaches a cabin, where he finds a young girl has been savaged by two men who have killed her parents. They've been with her for a week during this extended blizzard. Matt, by the end of the show, is able to, I shouldn't say able to kill them, but he does, gets them out of the way. And the closed scene is indicative of a Meston honest approach.
Marshal? Marshal Dillon?
What? Oh. Morning, Bill.
Come on out in the kitchen, Marshal. It's warm there, and I got some hot coffee waiting.
That sounds good. Say, it looks like the storm's lifted.
It has. The wind's gone, but it's mighty cold out.
Well, I don't mind the cold. It's that wind that breaks a man down.
There. Get some of that in you.
Oh, you make mighty good coffee, Belle.
Tell me something, Marshal.
Hmm?
Tell me the truth now.
Oh, sure, Belle. What is it?
Are you married?
I'd make a poor husband, Belle, for any woman.
Why?
Well, in my profession, it's too chancy.
Thank you, Marshal. Thanks for putting it that way.
Now, Bill, I didn't mean...
Forget it. I'm leaving this place, Marshal.
What?
As soon as you go, I've packed what I need and I'm clearing off.
Where'll you go?
I got 3 horses. I'll ride up to Hayes City and sell them.
Then what?
I'll buy some pretty clothes and I'll find a place. Won't be hard after this.
I wish I could help you, Belle.
You have.
Oh, but I mean...
I can take care of myself, Marshal. I just want to get away from here, that's all.
Sure. I'll stop at the nearest ranch and tell the men to come over here and take care of Hack and Alvey as soon as it warms up.
Whatever you like, Marshal.
Well, goodbye, Belle.
Goodbye, Marshal. Look me up in Hayes City next time you're there.
Sure. Sure I will. But, Belle, don't let all this make you bitter. There are a lot of good men in the world.
So they say. So long, Marshal.
So long, Belle. A few minutes later, I'd saddled up and was on the trail to Dodge. The sky was low and a slate gray all over, but there was no wind. The blizzard had gone, leaving the land still and white and bitter cold. There wasn't a sign of life anywhere. It was like riding through a vast tomb. I found myself feeling like a trespasser, as though something had gone wrong, and I wasn't supposed to be there at all.
John Meston had a very firm, fixed feeling about Matt Dillon's character, and he often said that Matt didn't want to see America grow west and with the sound of trumpets and flags flying. He always said that Matt was a very honest, real man who was doing a difficult job the best way he knew how.
Writer John Dunkel.
I think that he was a typical hero in the sense that he was a pretty intelligent, a very compassionate man, probably the ideal lawman.
There was certainly, the way Bill played him, a tremendously pathetic quality to Dillon. His opening line was, it's a chancy job.
Parley Bear.
I think probably Dillon trusted Chester and Doc and Kitty as much as he dared trust anyone. He knew that if he needed someone to stand at his back, Chester would be there. But I'm sure that in the back of his mind, he wasn't sure that Chester would function at all times. I think he had the same feeling about Doc. Doc was dependable, but every now and again, he'd get sauced up, you know. And maybe at the moment of removing the appendix, Doc could have been a little snockered. Chester was dishonest with many people, but had to be completely honest with Dillon. And there was Dillon's strength. Everybody had to be honest with Dillon, because insofar as a human being is concerned, I think probably of the whole cast, Dillon was the one who was most completely honest in his dealings with lawbreakers, in his dealing with the town, in his dealing with his everyday associates.
The woman in Dillon's life was Kitty Russell, owner and operator of the Long Branch Saloon, played by Georgia Ellis.
She was very generous, loving human being. She adored, of course, the 4 men in her life. Matt, predominantly, and then Chester, Doc. Not to say that she didn't have a certain kind of a ambivalent feeling towards Matt. I do think that she considered him sort of the boss man, and she adored him dearly, and I'm quite sure they were very compatible. Yes, they were lovers, the best kind, because they really, truly understood one another. So there wasn't need for too much talk. I don't think there was any forgiveness to be done, because I don't think Kitty was available to anybody else but Matt. Undoubtedly, she had wild dreams from time to time, which she realized were completely unrealistic, of Matt and Kitty and some large spread. But doing what? Who knows? Because Matt would never be happy doing anything but what he was doing. And she knew she would never be happy with Matt if he were not happy. So, no, she was resigned to serving booze and saying, be careful, Matt. And she didn't have anything left in the East, or wherever she came from, to go back to. So what the hell? She was stuck in Dodge City. She was a good girl. She made a lot of it.
There was a character in the first Gunsmoke script identified only as Townsman. Thanks to Bill Conrad, that townsman became Chester. Parley Bear recalls the story.
Bill Conrad named Chester. He said, Norman, I can't say, hey, townsman, come here. He said, he's got to have a name. Well, I was playing him as I played Chester. And so Bill said, call him Chester or something like that. And so Chester he became. When I gave Chester his last name, I had a broken speech. And this was weeks after we were on the air. I became just Chester. And I had a broken speech that read something like, well, as sure as, and Bill just let me flounder. He didn't stop me. We used to do that to each other quite a bit. And so I just ad-libbed, as sure as my name is Chester Wesley Proudfoot, and that's how Chester Wesley Proudfoot was named. And I can remember Bill, there was a Chester Wesley Proudfoot. Where did that come from? I said, well, got a broken speech and some, cut in on me there where like you're supposed to, and I won't come up with those names. So it was Chester Proudfoot.
Gunsmoke TV producer John Mantley once referred to Chester as a dim-witted town loafer. But Parley Bear, who created and portrayed the character on radio for nearly 10 years, disagrees.
I don't think he was a dim-witted town loafer at all. He was lazy. But he still did his work, and he spun his wheels a great deal and kicked a lot of gravel. I would describe Chester as being a dependable non-thinker to this extent. If we had a hypothetical case with 9 desperados holed up, and Bill, as Matt Dillon, had said, Chester, you watch the back door. And as they come out, you plug number 1, 3, 5, and 7. Chester would have said, yes, sir. And as they came out, he would have said, 1. Bang, he'd have let 2 go and he'd have gotten 3, he'd have let 4 go and he'd have gotten 5. Even though maybe 2 and 4 were bearing down on him, he would have said, Mr. Jones said to shoot them others, so them were the ones I'm going to shoot. And that's what, but no, Chester was energetic, he was loyal, at times put upon by everybody but Dillon. As we played it, Chester was not really, he was never really deputized. Chester got Dillon out of scrapes every now and again. There was a pathetic tone written in Chester. Chester realized his shortcomings. I remember one script he did, I can't think of the name of it, but Chester saved Dillon. And as they rode back to town, he said, you'd best not tell anybody about that, Mr. Dillon, because that it could embarrass you if people were to know that I had saved you. He said, we just won't talk about that. And I think that was basically Chester. He was a loyal, sensitive man who, much to Dillon's annoyance, put sugar in his rye whiskey and was overly fond of jelly. And as he confessed one time when Dillon said that chewing tobacco was a filthy habit, he confessed that he didn't really chew tobacco, that it was licorice. That was Chester, I think, and I tried to play him that way. As simple, but not a simpleton. Loyal, if not intelligent. The economy of the day got to him. Chester was never affluent. He had a great loyalty and pride. His family, I guess you would have been tantamount to sharecroppers or tenant farmers. I don't think they were ever great landowners. But Chester was fiercely proud of his family and defended them and had an absolute adulation for Dillon. Dillon was the ultimate so far as he was concerned.
The part of Doc Adams was brilliantly played by veteran character actor Howard McNear.
Howard McNear probably is the most fascinating human being I've ever known in my life. He was a consummate actor. He was a consummate human being. And all of this wrapped up in a pixie-like body, a wonderful comic mind that would make a laugh out of anything in the world. For, I guess, 10 solid years, he was the life of our cast. He and Parley combined were unbelievable in their making lightness and happiness and joy out of a common everyday experience. Howard and Parley are two people that everybody should know in their lives.
Bill named Doc, too. He was just Doc in there. And Howard McNear, who was so delightful in that role, but he played him with just a trickle of blood dripping from his fangs. And you got the feeling that Mephistopheles was looking over your shoulder a little bit as Howard played Doc. And Bill Conrad christened him Dr. Charles Adams, just, you know, for the cartoonist. Well, when you talk about Howard, all of the adjectives like wonderful, unique, magnificent come to fore. Howard, I think, was one of the most truly delightful people I've ever known, ever met, and I had never heard anyone who didn't like him. Everybody loved him. And he was an absolute asset to anything and everything he did. Later on, he became Floyd the Barber on the Andy Griffith Show. And he fell upon evil times. He had a series of strokes. He recovered from some, and then he would have some more. And it's to Andy Griffith's eternal credit that for a couple of years, when Howard was no longer ambulatory, he stayed on the show, and they would revolve scenes around him. He would be seated in his own barber chair or in a place out in front of his shop, but they always fixed it, accommodated the scene to Howard, and I think it's a great tribute to his ability as a performer and an actor that many people didn't know that he was suffering from any handicap at all, because he was sharp. He still had the same wonderful sense of humor, a real pixie sense of humor. And I can truthfully say that some of the happiest hours of my life were spent in his company. He lived between my house and the studio, and I used to pick him up and bring him back. And those minutes that we had week after week discussing the day's happenings or whatnot were marvelous. He was a man of strange attitudes at times and in strange inconsistencies, and that's what added to his charm. Howard was a thoroughly conscientious man, prepared at all times with his work. I've never known him to give a bad performance. And I worked on many shows with him aside from Gunsmoke. We were on there together, but he did a lot of lineups and escapes and whatnot. But he lived in absolute terror. And this I can't understand, because he was a graduate of the old stock company circuit, where you had to learn a new part a week while you were playing one, you know. But he was terrified that dialogue would be changed on him. And he had it specified that once he was given a part, that was it, and they wouldn't change lines on him on the set. And he didn't even like to write in changes on radio scripts. And that he abhorred change of any kind. And he sort of, he had developed an aura about himself as being very nervous and this, that, and the other thing. And he, He was a little on the hypochondriac side. He carried a variety of pills, which he was willing to share. I don't know how many people he started off on the, or gave them some malady that they didn't have through sharing his pills. I know he had a box of pills one day. I had a bad headache, and I asked for aspirin. He said, "You don't want to put that stuff in your stomach." He said, "That's not good." He said, "Here, take one of mine." He said, "Don't take that one. They cost 50 cents a piece, and besides, it's not for a headache." But he had a bottle of all shapes, sizes, and hues, and colors of pills. And I tell you, not only our business, but the world suffered a great loss when he was taken. And I don't know of anyone who is remembered more fondly by our profession than Howard.
Stories told about Howard McNair exemplify his wonderful wit and charm, and Parley Bear tells some of the best. Several years ago, Parley and Howard attended the funeral of Gail Gordon's mother, Gloria.
We went to this funeral, which is in Hollywood Cemetery, in a very small chapel, and the pews were very small. Only four people could sit in them, and they were very tightly squeezed in then. And as it came time for the show, I have to first of all say that in the old days of radio, you never had really achieved until you had what we called a conflict, that you had to get permission from one director to be late to his rehearsal or leave his rehearsal for time to go to another. You had finally arrived when you had conflicts, or when you had to pay a page to open an exit-only door for you to get from CBS to NBC in order to make the show. The conflict was the ultimate thing for an actor. Well, we were tightly packed into this pew, and as you do at a funeral, you remain quiet, and your tones are subdued, and your attitude too. And my watch was being repaired. Howard was on the outside, on the aisle. The funeral was set for 2 o'clock, and as we were sitting there, I leaned over to Howard and whispered, "What time is it?" And Howard, "What?" I said, "What time is it?" And Howard's reply was, "What's the matter? You got a conflict?" I said, "Now, cut out the nonsense, Howard. Tell me what time it is." Well, I remembered too late that Howard carried a pocket watch. My tongue's perspiring, and not a wristwatch. And so he had to lean way out, and I had to lean away from him. He's tugging to get this watch out, and as he pulled hard, the fob and the ring on the stem came out. "There now. Are you satisfied?" I said, "Well, it's not my fault. Why don't you wear a wristwatch like everybody else does?" So he got the watch out, fixed it, put the ring back on, snapped the watch open, looked at it, snapped it closed, and put it back in his pocket. I said, "Well, what? Then what time is it?" He said, "I just looked." I said, "But Howard, you didn't tell me." He said, "They're not late." He never did tell me what time it was. Another funeral, I told you, a good friend had passed away, Will Wright. And we kind of got everybody on there. I was on the member of the board of directors for the American Federation of Television Radio Artists. Will had served on the board for many years, and we attended the service in a body. Will was Presbyterian and also a Mason, and Howard went to the funeral with me, but he didn't sit with us on the board, but he sat with a very fine character actor by the name of Dick Ryan, who was a staunch Catholic. And as the service went on, they did half of Will's service Presbyterian, and the second half was a Masonic service. And when the service was over, we waited, and we came out, and I saw Dick Ryan and Howard come out of the chapel, and Dick Ryan's face was just suffused with purple. He was really visibly upset, and I thought, "Well, I'm sorry Dick's upset. I knew that he and Will had been good friends, but it didn't seem possible that Dick would be that emotionally upset about it." And I walked with him over to his car, and I said, "Dick, are you all right?" And his reply was rather strange. He said, "I will never sit by Howard McNair at another funeral as long as I live." Got in his car and drove off. And I said, when Howard and I got alone, I said, "What did you do to Dick Ryan?" And he said, "Oh, he's emotionally unstable." And I said, "Well, he's all upset. What did you do?" He said, "Well, he just went all to pieces for no reason at all." He said, "Well, the funeral was on." He said, "As you know, it was first of all Presbyterian, and it was Masonic, and I just leaned over and asked Dick, I said, are you fellows going to demand equal time? And what had happened? Dick, in his monumental effort to refrain from laughing and guffawing out, I saw him 3 days later. He said, my rib cage is still sore from that guy. He said, I nearly strangled to keep from laughing out loud. He said, that's a terrible thing to ask you at a funeral if we're going to demand equal time.
The pixiest charm of Howard McNair was even evident in where he went to church. Again, Parley Bear.
Howard was a tremendously religious man, but didn't really embrace any of the faiths as we know them today. He went to the church of his choice, which was one week one, or another week another, sometimes Unity, sometimes if there was a speaker he wanted to hear, the Emmanuel Baptist Church, he would go there. But when he passed away, his wife asked me if I would deliver the eulogy at his funeral, which terrified me. And she said, the only command I lay upon you is that it not be lugubrious, it not be sad, that it would be something that Howard would like. And the chapel was pretty cool. We were it was up at Forest Lawn. And I didn't go into the usual, he was born on this date and so on, but in eulogizing him, I said some of the things that I've said today, how wonderful he was, what a brilliant performer. And one thing led to another, I kind of got off my text and I started to reminisce from the pulpit about some of the things that he had said and done, and the chapel was filled with friends of his. And as I told one story that had taken place there, it got a laugh. And that scared me, terrified me a little bit. And at the end of the thing, people, in recalling the wonderful times that they had had with Howard, I got chuckles and real laughs in this thing. And I finished the eulogy. I didn't take it upon myself to rewrite any of the psalms, but I edited some, and I joined the several poems, psalms, to what I felt was a fitting tribute to Howard. And I said to my wife, I don't dare face Helen. I said, the last thing I wanted was to get laughs at a funeral. I didn't mean that. I said, I think I've committed a terrible thing. And as I walked over, Helen came up and she put her arms around me and she said, that's just exactly what Howard would have wanted. And it was an ironic thing that of all the things I've done, I think I got more letters of approbation from his friends saying how they had, if it were possible, had enjoyed a funeral. And I got a little note from Bill Conrad. He said, I know Howard loved you, but now he must adore you. And that was Howard. He was friendly and forgiving, even in death.